I do this for my culture, 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 culture. Peace and welcome back to For the Culture, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Thank you so much for checking in and riding with me this evening. Folks, for our final conversation tonight, we want to have a discussion about a phenomenon that you may not be aware of, but you might have been confronted with each and every day, especially on our everyday technology. Here to give us some insight about this new phenomenon called what they described as techno-racism is Professor Iremsen Wright, who's a contributor here to talk to us all about all things technology and, more importantly, how they impact us politically and socially. He is a professor as well as an author, and we're always happy to have him on the show to give us some insight about these issues. Professor Iremsen Wright, thank you so much, Professor. How are you this evening?
You know, trying to stay positive. How are you doing, Faraji?
I'm good. I am with you there, Professor. I'm trying to stay positive as well. But here's why this is kind of hard to do. When you think you have enough already on your plate, you now something else gets thrown in your face. And you realize, I have another battle to wage. I have to be on the front line, even while I'm on a virtual street. And this is what I got to do. Let's talk about this issue of techno-racism. This might be a very, very new term for a lot of people. So what does this actually mean, Professor? Why is there this new phenomenon called techno-racism?
Sure, that's a good question. So traditionally, you know, we think of computers as these kind of cold, calculating machines that just kind of tell the truth, right? Because math doesn't lie. So you put 2 + 2 into a computer and it tells you the answer is 4. But the reality is that people are discovering more and more that the biases and the prejudices and the preconceptions of the people who program computers sneak their way into the software that they make. And when we use that software to make decisions about society, about who's going to get a loan, about who's going to get into college, about who's going to be paroled, about who gets to live and who gets to die in the hospital, all of those decisions are currently being made with the aid of computer programs. And those kinds of decisions end up reproducing the biases of the society that make them. And that, in America in 2021, means racism.
Mm. So it seems like this is racism or beliefs or belief system that is racist in its foundation, that is transferred from one's mind into our systems of technology.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, the problem is that it's kind of a pass-the-buck mentality, you know. So, like, in the old days, you know, maybe you get, like, turned down for a loan or something, and the bank officer would say, hey, you know, it's not me. If it was up to me, I'd give you a loan, but, you know, it's bank policy. And they try to pass it up, you know, pass the buck up the chain. Now people can say, well, you know, it's not me, it's the software. You know, the software is telling me that you don't get a loan. Or the software is telling me that you're a match for the suspect in this crime. You know, don't blame me, blame the computer. And, of course, the problem is that the computers are totally unaccountable because nobody knows how they're programmed or what kinds of biases are baked into them. And those kinds of questions are never asked before these gazillion-dollar software packages get sold to police forces and hospitals and schools and all these other institutions that we rely on for our daily life.
So let me now that you're bringing up something that I think we need to kind of touch on a little bit, which is this relationship, or rather this kind of unbridled trust that we have in technology, in computers, and in just in the technology that we use each and every day. It seems that we have more trust in the technology than we do people. How did we get to that place, Professor?
Well, you know, I don't know about you, but I grew up watching, you know, awesome sci-fi movies and TV shows about talking computers who were going to be your best friend. And now everyone's got Alexa in their house. And what most people don't know is that, you know, Alexa's ready to send information about your private conversations to the police if they ask for it, which is not something that, you know, you would have seen in like Star Trek, for instance.
But so Alexa is worse than your friend than somebody in real life.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to.
Alexa will turn her back on you if the police just ask a question. Not even if the police hound her. The police just say, "What happened, Alexa?" Well, today he said he would rob a bank. I mean,
it's actually true. I mean, you know, those recordings. So the way that Alexa works is that it's always recording the sound in your house.
Yeah.
And, you know, so if you say, "Alexa, buy me 7 pounds of concrete," you know, next thing you know, Amazon's going to come up and deliver it to your doorstep. The only way that they can do that is by surveilling your household. And, you know, the police have successfully asked for and received those recordings when prosecuting criminal cases. So they are effectively, and, you know, the same thing goes, I don't know if any of your listeners are using Ring doorbells.
Yes.
Those are the network doorbells that have the webcam built into them.
Right.
That's owned by Amazon as well, and they actually are working with hundreds of police forces around the country to send the surveillance video from those doorbells to the police forces on demand, and
yep.
then using the Amazon-owned recognition facial reco software that identifies, you know, says, that's Faraji walking past my house, that they're also selling that into the same police forces. So they're able to use this facial recognition software on this surveillance footage that people are baking into their doorbells.
And I'm glad that you brought that up, because that brings me back to the original conversation of this techno-racism. It started from facial recognition software, right? It started from this technology that is a very biased technology, a technology that has mistakenly identified people for crimes that they have not committed. But this is the technology that police forces across this country use as quote-unquote evidence versus as just as a supplementary tool for investigations. This is the same technology that has determined that there is some ingrained racism even in our daily interactions with that technology. Am I explaining that correctly?
You are. That's correct. And it's important to point out that it's not necessarily because any single programmer is evil, or let alone that, you know, we have, like, you know, Hal from the 2001 movies, you know, an evil computer out there. The problem is that, you know, a lot of the biases that get baked into this technology is done so unintentionally and by accident. And the reason is that, you know, for instance, when they're training a facial recognition software, they might have more white faces than faces of people of color. And so the computer becomes better at differentiating between white faces than it does differentiating between faces of people of color, because that's the information that it's been fed, right? And then, you know, in addition, a lot of these software packages get put together using publicly available data sets. You know, remember, like, 10 years ago, everyone was uploading their photographs to Flickr, which was bought by Yahoo. Well, it turns out that because Flickr was kind of available to everybody, unlike Instagram, you could just log on and download every photograph on Flickr if you had enough hard drive space. A lot of these facial recognition algorithms are trained on that data set. And people put a lot of racist stuff into the comments and into the descriptions in Flickr. So that stuff gets scooped up by the software as well. And it can't differentiate between what's true and what's not true. All it says is, I have this information that corresponds to this photograph, and it stores it away in its database. And then you don't even know it's there until the police have a wrong match and they arrest you for a crime you didn't do.
Wow. Wow. Folks, if you're just tuning in to For the Culture here on WEAA, I've been talking to Professor Iram Sinwright of American University to give us some insight about a new phenomenon called techno-racism, and talking about how technology, everyday technology that we use, that we embrace, that we share all of our lives with, how this technology is biased. and that can lead to some detrimental consequences, especially if you're black. If you want to talk to us about this and you want to share your thoughts or pose your questions, you can do so at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, or you can post your comments or your thoughts on my Facebook page at Faraji Muhammad on Facebook. There was a study, professor, by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and they found that over 100 facial recognition algorithms found that they falsely identified black and Asian faces 10 to 100 times more than Caucasian faces. Now, with that type of figure, that type of data, I'm wondering, 10 to 100 times more, professor, it sounds not unintentional. It sounds very, very intentional. Should we take it that way? Or should we interpret that data to be such?
Yes, we should. And the reason is, it depends on your definition, right? So there's like sins of omission and sins of commission, right? Somebody does not have to have tried. You don't have to go out of your way to create a racist algorithm. If you know for a fact that the algorithm is going to be racist unless you try to make it not so, you're committing the crime of allowing it to be a racist algorithm, right? So we now know, we have a decade of research and data showing that facial recognition is fundamentally racist. I've never heard of a facial recognition software package that wasn't, right? So that's the standard. So if we know that for a fact going into it, if we don't take steps to fix it, and if we don't take steps to outlaw it until it's fixed, then we are enacting a racist policy by using it, because we know that it's flawed.
So if we know that it's flawed as the consumers of this technology, how come the companies of these technology, if we're talking about Microsoft, we're talking about IBM, we're talking about Amazon, what are they doing? First, do they know that this is ruining people's lives in some respect?
Of course they know. All of the companies that you just named have huge research departments and PR departments that are very, very aware of the problems in the technology. And we've begun to see a couple of the bigger companies, like Microsoft, saying, we're going to dial back on this until we fix our problems. And the reason they're doing that isn't out of the goodness of their hearts because they're great people. It's because they recognize that the public is becoming aware of these problems and there's going to be a big pushback. And they're going to probably end up on the wrong end of a lot of lawsuits that's going to cost them a lot of money and a lot of negative publicity. So what we, you know, the people who are not billionaires or software geniuses can do is to call our representatives, to take to social media and to say we will not allow ourselves to be held hostage by these racist technologies, and we should outlaw facial recognition until it can prove that it doesn't reproduce bias. We should not allow the police to have access to surveillance software from people's Ring cameras until we know exactly how they're going to use that information and until they're accountable for misusing it. Right? I mean, these are basic policies of transparency and accountability that nobody would think twice about if we were talking about human beings. But because it's a computer, everybody assumes it's just fine and we should just trust it.
So why is it, and I'm going to jump to my first caller, Zach, who wants to share his thought, but I'm interested, if these companies know it's faulty, we as the consumers know it's faulty, how come the police departments don't know it's faulty? Because the police are still making arrests based upon this technology, based on the number of cases about, being mistakenly identified for crimes. Will all of this shift police departments to rely less on on this facial technology?
Look, not with that pressure. Right. I mean, I would love for you to invite someone from the Baltimore Police Department onto your show and ask them that question point blank. Right. Because there's no good answer to that question.
Wow. Not without pressure. We got to pressure the people to do the right thing. That is.
Welcome to democratic society.
Right.
If it's the alternative.
Exactly. Folks, join us in the conversation right now, 410-319-8888. Zach, thank you so much for checking in. Zach, what's your take on this? Have you heard of this phenomenon of techno-racism?
Oh, my God, man. You guys have hit this. This is so real, what you're talking about. Let me tell you a little quick story. I'll try to make it fast and to the point. I have a friend of mine I grew up with. He's 50-some years old. He's almost 60. Matter of fact, he's 60 now. He was living in his house with his mother. She died 3 years ago, a year after she passed. The police at 4 o'clock in the morning bust into his house, just crushed his doors, his back door and front door in, dragged him out and took him down and said that they had a picture of him. No, the cameras or something picked him up or something, and they said that he had been down the Horseshoe Casino and robbed the place. This wow. boy has never even spit on the ground in his life. That's how honest he is. And they tore his house up. Do you know he's still trying to get them to pay for his door?
And that was how long ago?
This was 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
This is unreal, man. I mean, I'm telling you, this thing, that's really happened. And that's this kid has never done anything in his life. I mean, I'm telling you, he's the most honest child I have ever known in my life. And I've been knowing that boy since he was a child.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. And this guy's right. He's telling the truth. This has happened to a lot of people. And the police won't pay for his doors or nothing. It's crazy. So he had to put out his money and out of his pocket and pay for all of this stuff and trying to get it fixed up.
Wow. Wow. Hey, Zach, I appreciate you for joining us. And I think that just serves as a testament to exactly what we've been talking about. I mean, lives can really be ruined from faulty technology.
Technology, and that's exactly what has happened because this thing is not properly, it does not work properly, and I'm telling you. That is unbelievable that you guys would happen to be on here talking about this.
Yeah, I mean, the reason is that, one is that we want to let people know that this type of bias exists even within our technology.
Technology, and and it's true.
And two, that there has to be bigger and many more conversations that need to be had, especially
you are so right.
with the police departments and other law enforcement agencies that use this technology as the truth.
This needs to be talked about, needs to be put on TV. This gentleman should be on TV. He should be all over the news, everything. He should be all over every channel, every radio station, and speaking on this because this is really happening.
Yeah,
this is
right.
unbelievable.
Hey, Zach, I appreciate you, man. Thank
God
you
God bless
so much.
You, man.
God bless you, too.
God bless you and your show, man. I tell you, good guy.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you. Professor, I mean, a man is dragged out of his house at 4 in the morning for something he didn't do. Another story.
Yeah, it's absolutely tragic, and I'd love to say that it's just the fault of technology, but you and I both know that that's been happening for hundreds of years in this country. And you know, the problem is that it's a continuation, and it's a heightening of some of the dynamics we've already seen in this country, and it's happening just, you know, we're only half a century past real civil rights law in the U.S., and so, you know, this stuff hit right after we started figuring out how to make actual human beings accountable for their actions and actual institutions accountable for their actions, and, you know, this is like, it's like don't look behind the curtain, right? So, okay, yes, this human being is accountable, this department's accountable, but we're just buying the software package from this company. Like, you can't hold us. We don't know how the tech works. We just use it, right? So, again, it's this kind of, like, pass-the-buck accountability problem, and there's no way to fix that at the local level. You can only fix that with, like, state-level or federal-level laws
right.
that require some kind of transparency and accountability from the software before it gets used in a way that can impact someone's life that way.
So let's talk about it, because we've been talking about this facial recognition technology, and I'm wondering, one is, should we totally scrap that technology? Because I've seen it in films, you've seen it in films, Minority Report and all them other films. We talked a little bit about that. But should we just totally scrap the technology, or should we work to improve it, the data that goes into this technology, to be less biased? What should be the ultimate goal here, Professor?
That's a great question. My personal opinion is that I can't imagine a situation in which facial recognition technology makes the world a better place. I can only envision, let's say that they fix the racism problem, right? Which
said,
is not going to happen, by the way.
Let's say they fix the racism problem.
Yeah, exactly, right? But let's just say for the sake of argument that they figure out how to make a non-racist piece of software in a racist society.
Right.
Because it's too much to ask them to fix everything.
Right.
So even then, right, you have this problem of human end users, right? You know, it's like the situation with body cams, right? You ever notice how, like, a lot of times when, you know, the body cameras are supposed to keep police honest, but when something goes down, oh, my body cam, you know, wasn't working, or it got blocked by something, right? Because there's a human user at the end making the decision about what the camera's going to see and what it's not going to see, right? So in the end, you get a lot of police killings caught by citizen cameras and not by police body cameras. Right, it's exactly the same way with these kinds of algorithms, is that even if the technology itself miraculously becomes expunged of all racism, the end user themselves is not expunged of that, and they're going to end up using it in a way that reinforces their biases and their disproportionate power relative to the general public. And so any new tool that adds to the power of the few and takes away from the power of the many is going to undermine the democratic principles of society. Mm. My personal opinion is that facial recognition technology is bad and it should be outlawed. But if we can't have that, we should at least make it accountable and fixable.
Mm. Let's go back. Let's take one more call before we take our final pause. Tavon, thank you so much for checking in. What's your take?
How you doing, Farad?
I'm good, Tavon. How are you, brother?
I'm good. I agree with the professor. The facial recognition thing, that's a no-go for me. And technology as a whole, it's starting to get out of hand, especially now that they're starting to resurrect the dead people. You got Vince Lombardi giving speeches at the Super Bowl and other deceased coach Al Davis giving an interview on TV. But my question is, and it's kind of a rhetorical question, I'm wondering on a bigger scale, how does this bias now filter over into the population as far as for Baltimore City Public Schools, for instance? There aren't many STEM programs that will teach our kids how to prepare for jobs in this field. So therefore, it will create a disparity in the future jobs for our children. How does that? I mean, it to me, it seems like it's one problem is the bias with the programs, but it's creating a whole another an entire different area of problems as far as like the workforce in the future or. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it making sense what I'm saying?
Because, no. I mean, I think I'm understanding you. You're saying that if there's bias right now, then what does our future look like compared to if you got children who don't know, who are still challenged by just the technology? Now they may not even be aware that they're biased at this level, and they're programmers and designers who think this way. To program the technology to quote unquote think this way,
right? So, and those are opportunities that they will never have because,
yeah.
Unfortunately, academically they weren't afforded those opportunities. So it may be solving crime issues, maybe,
yeah.
But it's creating more poverty issues.
Oh,
more
I get it. That's a great
issues.
Question. Hey, Tavon, that's an excellent question. Look, we're going to take our final pause. When we come back, Professor, if you could speak to that, because I think that's a great question, looking at like the long-term effects of if you have this level of racism within the technology, this level of bias in the technology, then this may be another firewall by which black and brown youth in particular will have to either penetrate or climb, but that they're going to be confronted with, even in an industry that show that they're not well represented. So, how do they get past this? How do they work through it?
I think your caller was absolutely right. There's this feedback loop, right? So you can think about it in three stages, right? You have the labor force that produces the technology, and that labor force is artificially whitened by the fact that. That black and brown kids are not given access to the same educational resources and job resources as other kids in America, right? And that enters into the technology. And then you have the technology itself having the biases kind of baked into it and reproduced
in it, and then you have the kind of institutional uses of the technology being used to further pre-existing social racism, which, again, limits the opportunity of black and brown children to participate in the labor force. So it's this vicious circle between the three. And the answer, I think, to your question is that you have to intervene at each stage, right? So when it comes to the labor force, you have to invest in education for kids who are being disproportionately excluded from you know, getting into the good schools and getting the good jobs. For the technology, you have to have an independent oversight, preferably by the government, holding companies accountable for the products that they make and having some kind of a standardized audit to make sure that those products don't reproduce social biases. Mm. And then the end users, you know, whether you're talking about a bank officer or a police officer, they actually have to be accountable for their uses of the technology the same way that they'd be accountable for the use of a pen and paper or a gun, right? Ultimately, the tech is just a tool. You can't blame it for society's problems. You have to point the finger at a human being, and ultimately, a human being has to be responsible for their role in the process.
Hey, right? Professor, we got to stop right there. We got to take our final pause. When we come back, more of your questions. You're dropping so much jewels, and I truly appreciate it. We got Clarence, we got Gene, we got David, and we got Candace that are still checking in. So, folks, take a quick pause. When we come back, more of your questions as we continue to talk about techno-racism with Professor Irem Sinwright of American University. Stay riding with us. It's For the Culture on WEAA. I do this for my culture. Peace and welcome back to For the Culture. Right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely, the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Thank you so much for checking in and riding with me this evening. Tonight, we are talking about techno-racism, how your technology, my technology, can be biased against us, and how that may lead us into trouble. And here to give us some insight about this phenomenon, more importantly, how do we navigate through this part of a virtual battle of making sure that we don't become victims of our own technology has been Professor Irem Sinwright of American University and author. He's given us some great insight into this whole phenomenon. Professor, I want to jump right back into the calls because folks have been checking in. I want to hear from Candace. Candace, thank you so much for being a part of the conversation. What's your take on this, Candace?
Oh, I just have a quick question for the professor. What are your thoughts on personality assessments during the job hunting process? Is that a part of techno-racism?
Mm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Candace. Mm, didn't think of that one, Professor.
That's a great question. So I would say it's a precursor to techno-racism, right? So before we had all these kind of fancy algorithms and AI and machine learning, we did have systems that claimed to be neutral and unbiased and were actually used as ways to reproduce bias and to for people to have what's called confirmation bias. Like if you already think somebody's not going to be good for a job, it gives you an excuse to say that they're not good for a job.
Right.
I don't work in the field of psychiatry or psychology, so I can't say for certain that there's no such thing as a good personality test, but I can say for certain that there is such a thing as a bad one, and that they have been used in that kind of a context as an excuse to reproduce biases rather than to independently evaluate job candidates.
That's a great question, Candace. And you know, I know that there have been a number of, you know, some research and some study done that personality tests have been biased towards black folks because, one, the tests would develop at times where the culture and the attitudes towards black people, seeing black people as humans and all of those. I mean, this was in the early part of the 20th century. And so a lot of those tests come out of that space. And so, you know, when you're talking about personality tests, and I know you say you're not a psychologist or anything, but you're a critical thinker, Professor. So I think, you know, just a lot of those tests come from those attitudes, right? I mean, just like those tests, you know, the IQ test, people are pushing back on that and saying, well, this is not a good metric of determining one's intelligence because it's skewed, it's biased. It was not written to consider all of the new social factors that make people up, that you know, make people are, you know, who they are. And so, go ahead.
Yes, I was just going to say, you're 100% correct, right? The history of 20th century society, at least in the Western Hemisphere, is all about creating these kind of statistical models of how people should be, what the ideal person is.
Yeah.
And those models integrate racist logic into them in a way that structurally excludes black and brown candidates for jobs and schools and other opportunities based on what claims to be an unbiased measure, but is in fact a biased measure. And that is absolutely the legacy that these new algorithms like facial recognition technology are inserting themselves into. They're very much, as your caller pointed out, part of a longstanding set of practices. And that's why they've been adopted so quickly and easily, is because there was already a place for them in these institutions just waiting to be replaced by the kind of higher tech version.
Professor, I want to get one more question before we go back to the phone line. How does this work in the social media space when we're talking about Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, and all of these other social media platforms? You know, I've heard and I've read that that some designers and software developers, that they, because of their personal bias, they infuse it into those platforms. So you know, if you know certain ads come up based upon, you know, who we are and who, you know, how we present ourselves to the rest of the world. Can you speak on that? Because I mean, that can also fall under techno-racism, correct?
Yeah. So what you're talking about is it's a really important issue, and it's an analogous issue. Basically, most of the money that's been made on the internet over the last 20 years has been made from some form of targeted marketing, which basically reduces a person to a series of a couple hundred data points and then tries to sell advertisers and other people access to people based on certain data profiles. And social media companies, especially Facebook, but not only Facebook, have pursued profit without giving a lot of thought to the social impact of their marketing platform. So, for instance, until a few years ago, if you wanted to, you could buy an advertisement on Facebook that would target what Facebook itself called, quote, Jew haters, unquote.
Mm.
And Facebook didn't set out to say, hey, we want to, like, sell a bunch of ads to a bunch of anti-Semites. What they said is, here's the data. A bunch of people say they hate Jews. A bunch of advertisers want to target ads to people who hate Jews. We'll sell them Jew haters, right? That's their business model. So, you know, Facebook has absolutely been integral to creating a model that allows not only advertisers but also political actors who might have nefarious reasons to select individuals who might have hatred for a given ethnicity, or who might have psychological problems, or who might be prone to believing disinformation, and send them information that's going to inflame them and make them even more angry or more racist or more out of touch with reality for their own purposes. And the targeted marketing infrastructure is kind of the perfect tool for malicious actors to achieve those ends.
Mm. Folks, join us in this conversation as we talk about techno-racism with Professor Sinwright, 410-319-8888. Let's go to David. David, thank you for checking in. What's your take on it, sir?
Patience, a very important subject. I think I'm personal background, a data scientist, and I'm familiar with the ways that some of these insights are constructed around computer vision, facial recognition technology, and I think the professor did a really good job in breaking down sort of the three segments of, I guess, participants in the software development process there. I think, though, one thing that does sort of merit mentioning is that, like, as an industry, software developers, tend to skew socially liberal and tend to be, like, in their personal politics, progressive, which, you know, begs the question, like, if, you know, 99.9% of software developers aren't going out to intentionally discriminate, you know, where does this actually take place? Like, how does the bias sort of inherent in these algorithms sort of root itself? I think one thing that's sort of worth touching on is the actual methods in which insights are derived from large volumes of data. So if you, like, looking at, like, an artificial intelligence or machine learning model, for instance, a very common one is what's called a convolutional neural network, which extracts, just like actionable sort of conclusions from large volumes of unstructured data. In this case would be, you know, someone's facial features, facial characteristics. You could extract, you know, data points that assess their mood, that assess, you know, a lot of different things, someone's age, sex, et cetera. But really what it boils down to, in my opinion, is how not that these models exist or anything like that, but sort of how they're applied.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that comes to mind is, and apologize if I'm rambling here, but one thing that comes to mind is, like, up until not that long ago, it was legal to consider machine learning models in dictating someone's sentence if, you know, because a machine learning model could, you know, to a pretty significant degree, predict recidivism,
mm-hmm.
whether or not once someone got back out, if they were likely to reoffend. And, I mean, the model was technically accurate, but it absolutely was discriminatory in that, you know, one of the things it looked at is, you know, proximity to, like, say, like, proximity to liquor stores or proximity to, like home value in, like, median home value, something like that in your neighborhood. Anyone with, you know, an understanding of American history understands that, you know, or, like, institutions like the Federal Housing Authority artificially lower, or historically have artificially lowered, property values and sort of segmented Black people into specific neighborhoods. So mm-hmm. if you're using those features as, you know, predictive of recidivism, it might technically be accurate, but it doesn't account for what is just or what is fair. And I think until there is just a broader societal understanding that, you know, historical forces in the very, really not too distant past up to today, like, actually do have an outsized impact on the lives of people in Black community, like Black people in Black communities, there's going to be a conflation of something that is technically accurate versus something that is just.
Yeah.
And one final point I would like to say to the professor, I think you're talking about, it would be ideal to outlaw or just, you know, ban, allow the federal government to audit how these algorithms are sort of coming into fruition. I mean, if you're looking at machine learning models, though, like, in a neural network, each neuron in and of itself is, like, what's referred to as a black box, which, like, the model itself is referred to as a black box, meaning that all of the calculations that the model undergoes in order to, like, produce a conclusion cannot yet be mapped. We don't really have the technology presently to really map out everything that, like, an AI model is doing to produce a conclusion. So there's, up to this point in time, doesn't really seem like a way that we actually would be able to account for, you know, the specific calculation being made that contributes to, like, a racist outcome.
Yeah, David, I appreciate you. And I think all of that you just mentioned is something that, and I think, Professor, like, is like, that is the other ultimate goal. But I'm wondering, as I was listening to David, I'm wondering what's the likelihood we can get to those places.
First, let me say that I think David's description of how the technology works and why it reproduces bias even when that's not what the software developers necessarily aim to do is spot on. That was a great description.
Yeah.
To his last point, though, about the auditability of the software, the federal government doesn't have to look below the hood and find, you know, oh, this is the string of ones and zeros, or this is the line of code that's racist. Of course, there's no such thing. It's an emergent outcome. It's something that comes from the entirety of the technology in the entirety of its social uses. So the way that people have worked around that with other systems in the past is not to look at the object, but to look at the outcome, right? So the way that, that civil rights lawyers think about technology is in terms of what they call disparate impact, right? Does this technology have a different outcome for black end users than it does for white end users, right?
Yeah.
And that's something that you can measure even if you don't know exactly how the technology is working. So I think, you know, at this phase, that's the place to start looking for good systems to audit and hold accountable the manufacturers of these technologies.
Let's go back to the line. That's an excellent point. Thank you, David. Let's go to Clarence. Clarence, what's your take? No Clarence? Clarence?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead. Thank you for your patience.
The mapping, in my point of view, is not really necessary when you create something for an, with an intended use in mind. And you put it to the test, you should be able to discern the harm that it will do by the test results that you get. So, are you? Am I still there?
Yes, sir. I'm listening.
Okay. Professor, am I correct in what you're saying is that at this point now, the creator of the software is not responsible, and I'll use tangible, in this case, intangible, to say the real-world consequences like that were described, the kicking in the door, that the creator is not responsible for that and that the end user has no responsibility to ask the creator if, in fact, the Marty error. How many times does this thing make this soft piece of software create an unintended consequence? What is the factor of error here? So you're saying that legally, there's no nexus between the creator and the end user as a consequence or a legal consequence. Is that, are we there now? Is there a flaw in the what I just put forth? Thanks.
No.
Thank you, Clarence.
You're absolutely right. Sorry, go ahead, Faraj.
No, I'm just saying thank you. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, you're correct. Look, this is uncharted waters, right? The Senate and the House, like, they're lucky to get, like, a basic spending package passed. They're not going to do any kind of comprehensive regulation of AI, you know, this year, right? So then it's up to the courts. And right now there have been very, very, very few cases that have tested the proposition that software manufacturers are ultimately responsible for the harms done to people who are targeted by the end users of the software, right? It's so many links of abstraction that there's a plausible deniability. And that's a large part of the problem, is that everybody along the way, each link in the chain, knows that plausible deniability shields them from liability, from playing a role in the harm. And what I'm saying is that we need some kind of policy that is going to make the buck stop somewhere. And so that would mean in practice would be, like I said, you know, there's some kind of audit that shows that there's no disparate impact from the use of the technology, and Police Department X, let's say the Baltimore Police Department, is not going to buy this facial recognition software unless, A, there's some kind of independent audit that says that it's not biased against black and brown faces, and B, there's some kind of certification program for the police using the technology to demonstrate that they can use it in a way that doesn't introduce bias into the process.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back to the line. We got Cece. Cece, thank you for checking in. What's your take? This is very interesting.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am, Cece. Thank you for your patience.
Okay, no problem. I just wanted to add some other sources to this important topic.
Okay.
There's an organization called the Algorithmic Justice League, and it's founded by Joy Buolamwini. That's Buolam as in Mary, Wini. And there's a documentary that talks about this extensively called Coded Bias.
Oh, yeah.
And Joy, if I'm not mistaken, she had was put in charge of studying algorithms, and she discovered a racial bias. I believe she worked for Google and ended up getting fired by the data she presented. So this is very interesting information. Thank you for the topic. Look into these sources I just quoted. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cece, and I'm so happy that you speak of this. Yep, coded bias. I'm looking at the website right now. I'm sure, Professor, you've heard of this documentary as well.
Absolutely. And I know some of the folks at Algorithmic Justice League, and they're great scholars and activists. And actually, it was a woman named Timnit Jebru who was fired by Google for pointing out that their algorithms were biased. But she's featured in the film Coded Bias. There's also another organization called AI for the People, run by a woman named Mutale Nkande, and they do great work also. There's a lot of academics and technology researchers and political activists right now trying to battle this before it becomes a beast that we can't slay.
And you know what? Speaking of Google, Professor, I know that the Wall Street Journal hosted the Future of Everything Festival today, and Google actually had just spoken about this issue because they had announced that they plan to double the AI ethics research staff. They put a black woman by the name of Marion Croak to serve as the leader of this new effort, the leader of this team, to talk about responsible AI, to talk about the lack of inclusion, pervasiveness in the tech hub, and more importantly, to look at this type of issues of algorithms and make sure that Google's algorithm is more aligned with the movement for ethical AI. Talk to us about this. When we think of these efforts, and I'm looking at, you have a black woman at Google, when you see the work of the Algorithmic Justice League, when you see, AI for the People, and I'm thinking to myself, this is another whole battle. How much of these efforts do you think is necessary, and why? And I guess let's start with that. How much of these efforts are necessary to push a change in just the technology that we use?
Well, let me ask you this: how effective was ExxonMobil at self-regulating when it came to climate change?
Come on.
How effective was R.J. Reynolds at self-regulating when it came to lung cancer and cigarette smoking?
Awesome. Right? Yeah.
Google is not going to do any better of a job at self-regulating than those companies are, because there are literally untold billions of dollars at stake for them, right? So it's not that they're bad people. I mean, some of them are, some of them aren't, right? And it's not that the ethicists that they hire won't be good at their jobs. It's that the institution is incapable of self-regulation by virtue of the fact that it's a public company that exists in order to make a profit, right? And so that's why you need independent regulators who are going to hold companies accountable, where it matters to them, which is their bottom line, right? They should not be able to get a contract to do business with a government organization until they can satisfactorily show that they're not going to be introducing more bias into our social institutions.
Mm. And how much faith should we put into this government, especially under this new administration? I mean, Trump administration, you've been on before during the Trump administration, was one thing. But in the Biden administration, can we expect something different? Can we get a little further in this issue?
Yeah, he's already started to hire some really smart people at the federal level to start regulating technology, beginning with like antitrust. But I think I suspect his tech ambitions are pretty broad. Look, it's the government's not a silver bullet. We're definitely going to have more bad presidents in the future. hopefully not as bad as the one we just got rid of. But we can't count on them for everything. But what we can do is create a legal and regulatory structure that the courts can enforce independently of political tides. And it's not perfect, but that's how our system works, and it's the best thing that we've got. I mean, international treaties would also be a good idea. The EU passed a data regulation law back in 2018 that has had some teeth. I would love to see the U.S. pass a similar law, and for the for the countries to get together and create some kind of a real binding, you know, we have this thing called the WTO, the World Trade Organization. It would be great if countries were not allowed to do business with each other unless they obeyed some basic data privacy directives. Right now, that's not the case.
Professor, we only have a few moments left, and I want to use that time to allow you to share any other resources that you can offer that will help people to get a better context of the significance of this issue.
Well, it's really, you know, it's an octopus of an issue. So there's all kinds of different arms and legs to it. The ACLU is doing great work on this subject. There's an institute called AI Now, which is based out of NYU in New York, that's doing great work on this subject. I'm actually working on a new book called The Secret Life of Data, which should be published by MIT Press in about a year and a half. That, you know, I was literally writing about the stuff we were talking about today in my chapter two of the book. Mm. So there's a lot of people out there, and, you know, feel free to follow me on Twitter at ARAM. I retweet a lot of people who work on this subject, and feel free to reach out to me at American University. I'm happy to share resources with people who are interested.
Absolutely. Professor Ironson, right, and you know, one of our, I would say, you know, tech communications, political professors. I mean, he kind of brings it all together, folks, for us to understand and get a better understanding of the many layers to these issues. But Professor, we thank you so much for your time with us tonight to talk about this issue of techno-racism. My hope is that this conversation will spark in a lot of people greater interest to be much more responsible about their technology use and much more aware about the consequences of irresponsible technology use, and of course, making them empowered to want to engage with their technology and encourage other people to engage with the technology in a way that's going to bring some real equity to all. So thank you so much, Professor, for your time this evening.
Oh, my pleasure, Faraji. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Folks, man, oh, man, Professor Ironson Wright from American University. Man, I really wanted to have that conversation with us tonight because I'm hearing about this phenomenon of techno-racism. So I hope that you enjoyed that conversation just as much as I did. And again, going back to some of the resources that the professor named, you know, AI for the People, the nonprofit organization that's looking to challenge techno-racism. Then you also have, of course, as our wonderful caller brought up, you know, the Algorithmic Justice League. And check out that documentary, Coded Bias. Thank you. I want to thank my team, Dre Day, for making me sound so good. I want to thank my producer, Demi Goff. And I certainly want to thank all of you for being a part of the conversation, and our guests, Sister Denise Jones-Dorsey and Brother Garrett Good from Knee High. Stay tuned. Up next is Lola Within the Groove, as always. Make sure you check us out at weaa.org. Download us on all of your smartphones and devices, and take us wherever you are, 24 hours a day, 365 days a week on our WEAA app. As always, never be afraid to challenge what's wrong, stand for what's right while being yourself in the process. I look forward to talking to you tomorrow for another exciting conversation right here on For the Culture, right here on WEAA 88.9 FM. Absolutely, the voice of the community. And remember, Baltimore, do more, but be exceptionally good for the culture. Peace.